The presenting sponsor of Top Docs is Netflix, now presenting the documentary film The Greatest Night in Pop from director Bao Nguyen. Variety calls it irresistible, a backstage look at icons coming together for the sake of something greater. The Hollywood Reporter says it's an engaging blitz of nostalgia. The Greatest Night in Pop, now on Netflix.
So The Greatest Night in Pop is the untold and unlikely story of how in January 1985, the world's biggest musicians came together to create the iconic song, We Are the World, all in one night.
Hi, I'm Ken Jacobson, and welcome to Top Docs. Today, we're talking to director Bao Nguyen about his documentary, The Greatest Night in Pop. The Greatest Night in Pop had its world premiere at this year's Sundance Film Festival, and is now available for streaming on Netflix. Bao Nguyen is best known for his documentaries about Saturday Night Live, called Live from New York, and his portrait of the martial arts icon and actor Bruce Lee, called Be Water. I first met Bao back in 2011, at least met him via Skype, due to his really incredible student documentary, Julian, which won an award at the Palm Springs International Short Fest. It was great to reconnect with Bao about his riveting documentary, The Greatest Night in Pop, which focuses on the recording of the sensation that was We Are the World back in 1985. If you were too young to remember this or are fuzzy on the details, We Are the World followed on Bob Geldof's charity album, Do They Know It's Christmas, under the Band-Aid label, and was the forerunner to Live Aid and Farm Aid. This was the time when the rock and roll community really gathered together to try to make a difference. In this case, with We Are the World, the goal was to raise millions of dollars to help fight the famine in Ethiopia. While the project was the brainchild of singer and actor Harry Belafonte, it was really Lionel Richie who took the reins of this project, I would say, along with the producer Quincy Jones. Lionel Richie teamed up with Michael Jackson to write the song, and then the hard work began, which was to try to gather together as many rock stars as possible in one studio on one night because they had one shot to record this song. While there's some great interviews here with folks like Lionel Richie, Bruce Springsteen, Huey Lewis, and Cyndi Lauper, it's really the amazing behind-the-scenes archival footage that I think makes this documentary so special and so interesting. Through the archival, as well as the interviews, various subplots emerge, and you can actually see these things play out over the course of this one incredibly long evening as producer Quincy Jones tries to wrangle all these egos and different voices to try to make it all come together in one song. Amazingly, it does. And so does this documentary by Bao Nguyen. As usual, if you like this interview, please follow us and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and tell a friend. Also, please follow us on Instagram at Top Docs Pod and on Twitter, also at Top Docs Pod. And now, my conversation with Bao Nguyen, the director of The Greatest Night in Pop. Bao Nguyen, welcome to Top Docs.
Thanks for having me, Ken. I'm not sure if we should talk about our history because, like, you're one of the reasons I was just in the early aughts, I guess, of being a filmmaker, and you programmed my student film into Palm Springs Shorts Fest, and it won an award there, and it gave me the motivation to think that I can keep on making films. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. And actually, the last question, which I wrote, if time, next to... was going to refer back to your film from 2011, Julian, which I think is an incredible film. As you mentioned, it was your student film, but it was obvious to me that this was a filmmaker to watch. And it's been amazing to see your career unfold since that time.
Thanks so much. I remember regretting not being able to make it out to Palm Springs, but it'll always be part of, again, the reason that I decided to stay as a filmmaker. It's not an easy path to continue. But I think festivals are such an important part of empowering and inspiring filmmakers and artists to continue doing what they do.
They are. Let's start with your career. You've made several films about some very big cultural icons and institutions, particularly in the U.S. Your 2015 film, Live from New York, is about the history of Saturday Night Live. Be Water focuses on the cultural icon Bruce Lee. And now you've got The Greatest Night in Pop, which takes on a seminal moment in the 1980s, the recording of We Are the World and the phenomenon that that was. When you're taking on a project like these, how do you approach the topic knowing that they represent something quite significant in the culture that people have strong memories about if they live through them, and loyalty to these events and to these icons?
For me, I am always trying to find some personal connection, some entry point into any story, not just ones that are big cultural institutions or icons or moments. But I think about the work that I gravitate to as a viewer and as a person who loves cinema. I come into watching a film, entering it with this idea of escapism or something larger maybe than the life that is in front of me. But when I finish watching something, I want to come out with it thinking that that story or that idea, that film has reflected something of my own personal experience. And so that the baseline that I try to approach my films with now, I can go through the list. Live from New York was a film that's about sort of the history at the time of the 40th year anniversary of Saturday Night Live. I thought about how I first knew about Saturday Night Live, and that was watching it as a kid, sneaking away from my bedtime. My parents were Vietnamese refugees, and they didn't let me watch television. The only thing they would let me watch was like the 11 o'clock news, which is not like a great thing to have a little child watch. And that's their only thing that they sort of consume on screen. But because it was Saturday and I didn't have school the next day, they would let me stay up sometimes after the 11 o'clock news on Saturdays. And I would watch SNL, and it became my entry point into a lot of American pop culture, political culture that I didn't have access to otherwise. And so using that as sort of a touchstone for Live from New York, working with my producers, we were like, okay, let's look at SNL through more of an anthropological lens rather than purely historical lens or purely pop culture lens or a behind the scenes type of verite documentary. And so using that, again, personal experience, it helped me form the thesis for Live from New York. It helped inform every decision and choice I made as a director, be it from who we were going to interview to which sketch we were going to include in the edits. And then just going forward to Be Water, as an Asian American, it's hard not to be an admirer of Bruce Lee growing up. But I was not born yet when he passed away. I was born in the 80s. He passed away in the early 70s. And so my entry point into Bruce Lee was actually more of his immigrant story, him coming to America. Even though he's born in San Francisco, he left when he was an infant, grew up in Hong Kong, and then came back to America. He came to America with little family connection, little money in his pocket, on a boat from Hong Kong. And I thought about my parents, who were, again, refugees. They lived, or I shouldn't say lived, but they were in a refugee camp in Hong Kong for 6 months before they came to America in the late 70s with, again, little money in their pocket, little familial connection. And that was what connected me to the Bruce Lee story. It wasn't him as a martial arts icon. It wasn't him as a cinematic cultural figure, but it was the immigrant. And I think that hopefully came through in the story and, again, the thesis of the Be Water. And then taking it up to We Are the World, which is probably like the most distant, really me trying to struggle to find my personal connection. Because to be honest, I was only 2 years old when the song came out.
I was wondering if you were born yet. So 2 years old.
Yeah, I was not old enough to understand the sort of reverberation that it created at the time. Obviously, I know about the song. And because I know about the song, even though I was only two at the time, I knew how big the song was. But at that moment when it came out, I didn't know how big of a cultural moment it was. But I do remember, again, it's going back to my parents. There's this through line of all of my films of my parents who spoke little English back in the early 80s when the song came out. But they had Lionel Richie records. They had Kenny Rogers records. And they had the We Are the World record. And so that became, in a way, you know, pop music, pop culture of America was that bridge for me and my parents' generation. So that became how I view We Are the World, as this moment that could transcend borders and transcend language And funny enough, when I was still on the fence whether or not I was going to make the film, because there's, again, a lot of questions that I asked myself. Am I the best filmmaker to tell the story? What's my personal connection? And very pragmatic things like, can you make an entire documentary film about one song? There's not many films that are made about purely one song. Am I going to be able to handle listening to this song over and over again in the edit? Luckily, the film is very much a process film. And so you don't really hear the entirety of the song until the very end. But it was serendipitous. I was in Vietnam, where my parents have since moved back, visiting them. And I got in a taxi cab. This 70-year-old Vietnamese taxi cab driver spoke no English. He picked me up. He put in a mix CD. And the first song that he played was We Are the World. So that became the serendipity for me and that personal connection that, like, how has this song, again, been able to transcend generations and language and borders? And I wanted to dissect that in this film, but in a very elemental way. There's many different ways to tell the story. One was like talking about the impact of it and looking at how it has reverberated around the world. But for me, when I heard the story of it, it was such like a cinematic story. You know, it wasn't a conventional story. The song was made in one night. There are all these elements of cinema and genre that I just popped up in my head when I read about that night. And so the ability to say, okay, this is a specific type of film, specific type of way of telling the story that I think is unique to me, helped me on top of that serendipity that I talked about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, don't argue with serendipity when it falls into your lap or occurs in your taxi cab ride. While We Are the World was the brainchild of the legendary singer, actor, and activist Harry Belafonte, and the film incorporates numerous participants' perspectives, it really is largely told from the point of view of pop star Lionel Richie. He carries the narrative from beginning to end. Did you know from the outset that Lionel Richie was going to take on this central role?
Not from the conception of the film. For me, even though we're dealing with a subject matter that's larger than life in terms of the song and then the people involved, I'm always like trying to find the proximity to the story as much as possible, the proximity to the experience of these participants. When you're making a film about an event that happened almost 40 years ago, unfortunately, there's a lot of the participants who are not around to tell the story. And I knew I wanted to find someone who could speak about it from day one up until the very end. And Lionel, in terms of just a happy coincidence, became more involved with the project. And he helped us become our narrative anchor in many ways for the film. We reached out to Harry Belafonte and Quincy Jones, who were other people who were still with us at the time, to help tell the story. But I think in terms of just the ability to have a freshness to it, to be honest, to be frank, Lionel was the best person. And Lionel is such a great storyteller. He was the very first interview we did. We did about a 3.5 hour, 4 hour interview with them, and he wanted to keep talking, and his manager had to stop him and just tell him we got to go. But I knew after that first interview with him that he was the one that could help carry the story narratively. I'm always skeptical about making films about the past and you're constantly cutting to a modern contemporary talking head interview. Just because for me as a viewer, it jolts me out of the time, the immersion into a story, into a moment. But I think with Lionel and Huey and Cindy and all these amazing participants, and also for the most part, we shot every single interview in the actual studio. And that was really important for me. For me, an interview is not just an interview, it's a scene. They're telling a story in a space that matters. Nothing is ever a throwaway. And to like replace them in the environment where it happened, it helps conjure a lot of memories of that night. For me, there's a spirit being there. Again, there's a story to it. You're telling the story in the place where it happened. Yeah, bringing Lionel there, he hadn't been there in a while, back for the first time. These memories again flooded back, and he helped really anchor the film in so many ways.
I thought he really was a revelation as far as his storytelling chops. He really is a master storyteller. He's funny. He's specific. He's emotional. And then even as you talk about shooting at A&M Studios, he references it in his interview. And that kind of brings the present back in line with the past. So What an amazing protagonist for this film. I do want to go back to Harry for a moment, Harry Belafonte. He was a huge star in the 50s and 60s, really a transformative performer who broke racial barriers and taboos in this country. He was also a close and important ally of Martin Luther King's and the civil rights movement. Clearly, his activism in the 60s and since that time is really what gave birth to We Are the World and also drew many people to the project. What's interesting, though, in terms of historical context is this is happening in 1985. It's no longer the 60s. And we've got the time of Reagan and Wall Street and so on. It's just a very different time in the culture and in the history of rock and roll. You know, by this time, rock and roll was no longer really affiliated with activism in the same way that it was in the 60s. Do you think in some ways that We Are the World was a test of the rock and roll community to see if rock and roll and its lead performers, its stars, stood for something more than itself?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't know if I'm qualified to answer it. I can give my own opinion, of course. Obviously, before We Are the World, there was Yelled Off and Band-Aid. And that was largely like the immediate catalyst for Harry Belafonte picking up the phone, talking to Ken Cragen, talking to Lionel. Obviously, there's Harry Chapin and a lot of sort of hunger campaigns. But it wasn't the same way, I think, that We Are the World lit, especially the American music community, lit a fire under them in many ways. When we talk about it in the film, I can just only talk about the evidence I saw from making the film, but it did help inspire a lot of the 80s pop stars. And again, I was only 2 years old when the song came out, but from my brief time in the 80s, the 80s to me, looking back at it, was maybe a decade of opulence and of glamour, of, you know, poppiness. And I think We Are the World became this perfect quintessential culmination of all that within a song. To be completely honest, like the song, when I was young, I thought the song was very corny and many people still do. But I think Bruce Springsteen said it very well in the film that you could judge the song aesthetically, but it became a tool. And so like aesthetically, it represented, I think, the 80s very well. But it morphed into something that became the celebrity philanthropic venture, for better or for worse. I think there could be some cynicism and taken that these celebrities are just doing this as a vanity project. But with Belafonte, I think he's always just set the tone for the sense of quote unquote celebrity activism, where if you have a platform, if you can help one life with that platform, that's better than doing nothing, than just sitting on your hands and being cynical in some ways. I think that obviously the song couldn't happen without Harry Belafonte, but his continued involvement, you know, appearing in the actual song, legitimized it for a lot of young artists at that time who might have seen it as a way to sing on a Michael Jackson song, right? I think there is this push and pull between what an artist might do for themselves at that time and what they do for the greater good. But I think this, again, was a moment, an experiment that was thankfully successful for the most part in creating awareness for famine in Africa. And if, again, with Belafonte's sort of mantra of you can save one life, then you step in and you do it. I think it achieved that.
For many of us who lived through it, yes, it did seem like a corny song in many ways at the time. And I think Springsteen very generously kind of, you know, addresses that respectfully. But watching your film, it fully dawned on me what an important moment it was and how unselfish these performers really were in bringing to the project what they did. There are a few really emotional high points in the film, and one of them involves Harry Belafonte. I mean, it's interesting. He kind of was the instigator of this project. As you mentioned, he performs in the song and the video, but he's in the chorus. He's sort of in the back there. He's just one of the crowd. But then there's that moment when I think it's Al Jarreau starts in with a version of Deo, and everyone chimes in and sings that song. And you just see the reaction on Harry's face, and it's just an incredible moment.
Yeah, and we were almost picture locked a week before Harry sadly passed away. But on top of Ray Charles being an obvious cornerstone and veteran of that group, Belafonte, Harry Belafonte, in so many ways represented so much of that, for the lack of a better term, like older generation, the old vanguard, passing the baton to the younger generation to continue the work that he's done. Yeah, again, I think his presence really added to the gravitas of it all. And that moment is, again, these things with documentaries, you can't write this type of thing. So when Al Jarreau, if Al Jarreau wasn't drunk, then maybe he wouldn't have started that Deo sing-along. You can laugh at Al Jarreau's not unpredictable. I mean, if I was at an award show and then I had to go sing a song, I'd probably be celebrating a bit as well. But they all kind of like are interconnected. And that moment is one of my favorite moments of making the song.
We talked about the interview with Lionel Richie and how great that is. All of these interviews are really terrific. But what makes this film so incredible, so riveting, is the behind-the-scenes footage of the shooting of the final recording of We Are the World single on January 28, 1985, a historic moment. It's hard for me to pin down exactly why, but for all the backstage VH1 behind the music kind of footage that we've seen over the years, somehow this footage seems different to me. It's revealing and revelatory about these musicians in ways that that kind of footage almost never is. I don't know if you agree with me or not, but what was your initial reaction to seeing the footage and going through it with your team?
This footage has been seen before in the music video and various clips, and there was a Jane Fonda hosted TV special back right when the song came out. So the footage wasn't new to me, but there obviously in those versions, there was a awareness to edit them in a way that might not be as raw as the way that we had hoped to present it. My editor, Nick Zimmerman, and I really combed through all the moments, and it could have been a longer film, could have been like a Get Back series in some ways. But I think we were very adamant about making sure that the participants had some sort of arc to their story. It wasn't just expository. When we show Bob Dylan in the beginning being nervous, there's a payoff later on. No spoilers if people haven't seen the film, but he's helped by one of the greatest legends in music and finds himself in many ways. And so we made sure that if someone entered the film in a maybe comedic way or a way that was less than illuminating, by the end of the film, there was some sort of arc to their story. And I would say for me, the lead up to the night, not to say it was just as important, but it helped add to the weight and the gravitas and the pressure of the night itself. You mentioned the archival from the recording studio. There wasn't that much archival of before that. And so we had to do a bit of movie magic by doing some recreations. So the first half of the film is mostly recreations, but with the audio of David Breskin, who was the Life magazine journalist who was covering it, who turned on his dictaphone from day one of the assignment. So there was all this audio archival that we were able to procure and add texture to the recreations. And for me, recreations did not feel like recreations. They should just feel like archival. They should just feel like the language of the film, the visual language of the main foundation of the film, which is obviously the recording. And so when we were doing the recreations, I was very adamant about using the exact same cameras that they shot the night of the recording on, which wasn't very easy to find even in Los Angeles. And to make sure that when we shot the recreations, we weren't shooting it in a way that felt cinematic, that again, jarred an audience out of the time and out of the experience. So the way I like directed the recreation scenes, working with my production designer, Hanrui Wang, and my cinematographer, Caleb Heller, was to almost like step in the shoes of this behind the scenes documentary crew that was documenting the making of the song. And that would be the aesthetic of these scenes rather than, again, a very highly stylized cinematic recreation. And I think that's the trick, the sleight of hand of us in a way, because a lot of people don't know that there's recreation in this film, which is great. But also there's people that are just like, oh, there's like, you just handed all this footage and you made this film. But there is some, again, storytelling that is involved and some directing. And I owe it to my crew and kudos to them for making it seamless. Because again, I wanted the viewer to just feel like they were in that month before the making. And then obviously the night of, feel very immersed in that.
I think you make a great point in that it's all the documentary elements, including recreation, which helps support the behind the scenes footage. and the interviews also. So, for instance, if we just saw that footage of Al Jarreau without hearing somebody talk about how he was always requesting wine, you know, throughout the evening, it wouldn't mean nearly as much as it does. And you begin to look in the footage itself for the truth that people are talking about in the voiceover.
Yeah.
And certainly the recreations, I would agree, are executed very well and just work seamlessly with the rest of the footage.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency, and I'm certainly guilty of this, of not trying to rely on interviews or any sort of like voiceover. I think most documentary filmmakers want to be in the most purest form of like cinema verite, behind the wall, and just let the footage play itself out. But when you have someone like Huey Lewis and you can get into his psyche of that night and him to talk about it, again, all these tools and techniques of filmmaking, especially documentary filmmaking, I wanted to make sure that they were utilized to really complement and reemphasize important parts of the film, important parts of the story.
You mentioned the footage of Dylan, and to me, this was definitely one of the high points. Like many people, you know, I've been watching Bob Dylan in documentaries since Don't Look Back, which came out in 1967, Pennebaker's classic film. And Scorsese has made numerous documentaries about or with Bob Dylan in them. What I've never seen is Bob Dylan in any of that footage lacking self-confidence. But here it is in spades in this documentary, and it's really almost shocking. He looks so uncomfortable. He literally seems to have lost his singing voice. He can't seem to locate it until this moment that you describe where, you know, he basically calls in somebody to help him, and ultimately the kind of the dam breaks and he's able to deliver his lines as only Bob Dylan can. Did you have in mind these other documentary portraits of Dylan as you were putting together this film and think about how this was adding to the kind of legend and the reality of Bob Dylan on film?
Yeah, to me personally, Bob Dylan is such a mystery. Unless you're a Scorsese, it's hard to get an interview with Dylan. He was always like the top of the list if we could get it. And I was very pragmatic, thinking there's no way we're going to get it. But again, Springsteen, in his wise words, he calls Bob Dylan an enigma in the film. And I actually, now looking back at it, not having him be interviewed, he remains that enigma to viewers. But as you said, it's such a different perspective onto Dylan that we've never seen before. And I wasn't like honing in on Bob Dylan specifically. I wanted the whole film to be this idea of looking at these icons and humanizing them and making them vulnerable. You know, the Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, Bruce Springsteen, the list goes on. When you see them in their other type of film projects, they do exude this confidence. But when you put them all in a room together with their peers without any sort of team behind them, then they become human. There's multiple people in interviews that have said, and I think Lionel says it in the film, that it felt like the first day of kindergarten, right? I think that's a feeling that most of us can all relate to. But now you're thinking about Bob Dylan walking into his first day of kindergarten. And again, for me, when I'm making films, I like to create a sense of proximity to the participants of the story, be it Bob Dylan, be it Bruce Lee, be it my very first film, a Marine who decides to go into war. And if you can create that proximity and deconstruct that mythology of a human being, I think that's the power of the form of like, how do you humanize someone who to you might be considered beyond human in many ways?
Yeah, I think nobody in the film probably represents that idea of proximity and fragileness more than Huey Lewis. And one of the themes of the film does seem to be this question of, do I measure up? That's a constant refrain for him, because after all, in the moment, he was called upon to fill in for Prince, who decided not to show, and Huey was tapped to do his lines in the song. He talks about, and we see that he's a little bit freaked out at first, but ultimately he delivers. But it's his modesty and frankness that really makes him, I think, instantly likable in the film. What else can you say about Huey Lewis in terms of the interview you did with him or just the role he plays in this group and also in the film?
Yeah, well, like funny anecdote from the day we shot the interview. He lives in Montana now, I believe, and he has a family member, a close family member who lives in LA. And we shot Huey early in the morning. He flew in, came straight to A&M Studios, which is now Henson Studios. And we spent a couple hours with him. He was done by 11 a.m. and he wasn't meeting his family member until 3 p.m. And he's like, do you mind if I just hang around and watch y'all do what you do? Because I have time to kill and I can't meet my friend on the West Side until later. But I'd love, you know, you all were so great. And I just want to hang around. And that was just like, this is after spending 2 hours talking to him and just seeing how humble and modest and nervous he was about that night. I always loved Huey Lewis and especially Huey Lewis and the News and their music. But when I met him, he was just the most gentle man that I've ever met. And he continues to talk about that night with such effusiveness. And I didn't know that story, that he was the one that was supposed to replace Prince. And right now, there's a lot of social media memes where Michael Jackson is giving the side eye to Huey Lewis and Cyndi Lauper and Kim Carnes, because Michael Jackson just like really kills his line. And then he has to see like Huey Lewis, who a lot of young people don't know who Huey Lewis is. But I think hopefully with the context of the story through the film, people will understand that when you're taking Prince's line, you have to sing after Michael Jackson in a room full of Stevie Wonder, Bruce Springsteen, Diana Ross, you're going to be a little nervous. And then he's asked to do a three-part harmony with Kim Carnes and Cyndi Lauper. And it was funny. It's not until I hear the song in its individual segments that I realize how well everyone can sing. Like, I never thought of Huey Lewis as this amazing singer. I love his songs, but he's not the same as a Diana Ross or Michael Jackson. But because you're able through this film to segregate each part of the song, you realize Cyndi Lauper's got pipes like no one else. That's now my favorite part of the song, is her part. But yeah, again, it's being able to talk to someone like Huey and see his modesty and see how much of a fan he was of everyone else. There was an approach that we were thinking of taking early on in the process where we would interview like musicians from today, like pop stars from today, and they can talk about the song and how much it's influenced them or how big of a fan they were. But I realized, again, that would be a different type of film. And to hear that same sentiment through someone who was there on that night, like Huey Lewis talking about how big, again, Diana Ross was or Billy Joel was or Stevie Wonder was, right? And then talk about how big of a moment it was for him. He became that conduit to talk about, to be the fan of the song and of all these artists. And I'd be remiss not to mention Ken Wu, who was one of my favorite participants in the film, who was one of the camera operators that night. He also became like the way that we talked about how big of a song this was, how impactful a night it was, and how big these artists were, again, within having his own story of that night himself.
He also adds to the process film aspect of this, because we hear through his story about shooting the event and the challenges of that. The challenges were immense. And so let's talk about Quincy Jones, because he's the producer of this song. He's a legendary producer, but he really does an amazing job. This is not an easy lift. You've got to get all these different voices in the song doing their bit. You have to sort of wrangle all these personalities, all these egos. You have to make this song come together technically, and he's the ringmaster of it all. What impressed you the most about Quincy Jones in the course of looking at the footage and talking to people about the making of the record?
I think for me, and it's not surprising, it sort of reinforced an idea that I already had of Quincy Jones, of like how much respect that everyone in that room had for Quincy Jones, how much reverence that they had for him, that someone like Dionne Warwick, who was, is, still is an icon, left her gig in Vegas and flew to LA not knowing anything about the project other than that Quincy was involved. And so everyone who walked in that room sort of blindly not knowing what the song was, they came in mostly because of Quincy, because again, of how much respect that he commanded I think it'd be hard to find someone today in any industry, really, that can unify their community, their group of colleagues, of artists to do the same. And so in many ways, he's a figure and an icon of a bygone era. But I do hope that maybe through the story of this film and this, what happened that night, that people can realize with great respect and power, people will follow you in the best way possible. That reverence is maybe feels a bit old fashioned, to be honest, sadly. But I think a new generation can hopefully look to stories from the past to inspire them. And same with Harry Belafonte, you know, by speaking highly of Quincy, I don't want to dismiss the attraction of Harry Belafonte being bald. But people didn't know if Harry was going to be there or not, but they knew Quincy was going to be there. When Quincy makes a call, then you listen, as Tian said in the film.
And the capper of the Bob Dylan story is after he's done his lines, I think he's still not sure he got it. And he turns to Quincy to reassure him that they're okay. And Quincy says, yeah, we got it. And Dylan says, I know you know. And to me, that encapsulated just the entire relationship between artists, musicians, and producers. If the artist can feel about the producer, I know they know we got it, that's a great relationship.
Exactly. And then on top of that, Huey mentions in the film that a great producer is not just a great sort of like great at production, but they have to be a psychiatrist, right? And Quincy, throughout the film, just shows his leadership model and the way that he was able to handle all those personalities, all that vulnerability, all that anxiety that people were having, and reassure them at the end, even though they didn't think they got it. For an artist like Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen to just look to Quincy and say, do you think I got it? And he's like, yeah, and that's enough, right? I don't think they would do that to any other person.
One of the more emotional moments for me also involved Michael Jackson, who co-wrote the song with Lionel Richie. And he's the first one to arrive at the recording session well before anyone else. We see him at the mic, and there's Quincy in the control room. And we just hear Michael sing by himself. It's, for us, it's an a cappella version at that point. Hearing him sing, it just sent shivers up and down my spine. He did have an incredible voice and presence, and he was a great songwriter. Certainly, he's one of the most complex, troubled, and deeply flawed pop stars we've ever had in this country. How do you think that moment, and We Are the World overall, adds to the complicated legacy of Michael Jackson?
Great question. The idea of Michael Jackson as a whole was something that, as a film crew, we interrogated over and over again. But going back really to your very first question about like how I approach these big concepts and ideas through specificity, through intimacy, through proximity, it helps form the choices that I make as a director, as a storyteller. Because the thesis of this film and the title implies that it's the greatest night in pop, right? And so we're very much focused on what happened on that night and sort of the periphery of that night. And with the material that we had found in research in terms of the archival, not just the visual archival, but the audio archival, you hear the genius of Michael Jackson through his voice, through his talents, through his songwriting. And that was the Michael Jackson that was presented in this moment. And it shows, you know, with great genius, again, comes great complexity and darkness. But this film was about this night, about this song, right? And certainly if there's anything that ever surrounded this song and that night, that's something that I think I would have, again, interrogated and mentioned in the film. But through the lens of the story, this is how I saw Michael Jackson and how it, again, showed his talents and genius in many ways. And his insecurity, to be honest, like he didn't even want to be on the song. He just wanted to write the song. I think there's a lot of complexity and it's hard to explain in one film, let it be multiple films.
Yeah, it's extraordinary to witness how many of these superstars are suffering from insecurity like all the rest of us mere mortals. Last question, we're coming up on 40 years since We Are the World. As we mentioned, there was Band Aid and the song that kind of kicked us all off the year before, Do They Know It's Christmas? Then there was Live Aid, Farm Aid, which is actually still going. But nothing seems to have really captured the imagination the way We Are the World and these few events did. Do you think something like We Are the World could happen these days And would it have the same impact?
I think the film has resonated with people so much because this moment felt so singular and was so transformative for many people. And I think as witness to the film itself and the story, it was not an easy thing to do. The logistical nightmare, the technological obstacles of that time, and the time crunch. Everything would have said this shouldn't have been pulled off. I think today, given social media, the internet, the logistical things might be somewhat easier, but to surprise the world the way that We Are the World did, I think would be very difficult. I think people would find out where the recording was happening. You couldn't get a room full of artists without their management and their publicists. So I hope it could exist today. It would certainly take on another form. I think I've been encouraged now with the release of the film, many artists, from K-pop artists to Justin Bieber to a lot of different artists, saying how inspired the story was after watching the film. I take that with a bit of optimism and hope that what started with just a phone call from Harry Belafonte became a global iconic moment. Maybe today that can still happen for sure.
Well, Bal, thank you so much for being with us today. It's great to talk to you, and congratulations on the film. For those who remember We Are the World, it's revelatory to learn these stories and to hear these perspectives 40 years on. And for those who are too young, I'm sure this is an amazing discovery. So thanks again and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Ken. It's good to see you.
Do you have a hidden gem, a documentary that you think maybe doesn't get quite the attention it deserves?
Yeah, this is a film I haven't seen in a while. I've seen it 3 times in my life, but I remember the first time I saw it at a film festival in Los Angeles at the LA Asian Pacific Film Festival. The Emperor's Naked Army Marches On. It follows a World War II soldier sort of seeking redemption and vengeance in many ways across his former soldiers in his unit. I don't want to talk too much about it because if you watch it for the first time, you are in for a surprise in many ways in terms of cinema, especially documentary cinema, and just storytelling and humanity or inhumanity in some ways. It was a film that really shocked me because it was something I'd never seen before, and it showed me the potential and the power of the documentary form.
Top Docs is a production of Woolly Media. This episode was produced by Ken Jacobson and Mike Merrill, and edited by Mike.